no one wants to hear about a relieved widow, like sexually exploring. We're not supposed to talk about that. We're supposed to be in grief and we're supposed to look a certain way and act a certain way and feel a certain way. And all of the things I was supposed to look and act to be like were not my experience.
You're listening to the Mother of Reinvention Show, a weekly podcast about midlife motherhood, careers, health, relationships, and more. I'm Megan Francis, a 40-something mom of 5 kids ages teen to young adult. Listen each Thursday as I bring you an interview with an inspiring mother of reinvention, plus some of my thoughts about wellness, self-care, relationships and divorce, big kid parenting, and more. It's all at motherofreinventionshow.com. Keep listening for another episode of the Mother of Reinvention Show. It's what's next for midlife moms. If I'm being honest, I spent a decent chunk of my 30s thinking about divorce. Sometimes I was actively trying to avoid it. Sometimes I was fantasizing about what my life might look like after marriage. Either way, I'm not at all surprised looking back to find myself as a divorced woman in my mid-40s, and I'm sure I'm not alone there. But whether we're happy in our marriages or not, most of us in our 30s and 40s and maybe even 50s don't give a lot of thought to becoming single through widowhood. Being a widow feels like something that happens to older women, like the Golden Girls, who it turns out weren't even that old, but that's another topic. Typically, we think of widows as bereaved and having come from happy marriages. And while that may more commonly be the experience, it definitely leaves out the stories of people like today's guest, Rebecca Wolf. I've known Rebecca for years, going back to the early mom blogging days, and I've always admired her gorgeous writing and most of all her honesty and willingness to tackle tough topics. When Rebecca shared online that her husband Hal was facing a terminal cancer diagnosis, and then when he died just a few months later in October of 2018 at the age of 44, our community was shocked and really rallied around Rebecca. But what most on the outside didn't know was that their marriage had always been complicated and was drawing to an end when he was diagnosed, and that Hal's diagnosis and death put Rebecca in the complicated position of supporting him and their 4 kids through his death and publicly being a grieving widow while also finding relief in the ending of a relationship that had been unhealthy and unraveling for a long time. Rebecca's new book, All of This, A Memoir of Death and Desire, tells the story of that marriage, Hal's illness and death, and how Rebecca has grappled with and embraced her young widowhood, even when her experiences haven't fit the expected narrative. In this episode, Rebecca and I discuss everything from dating as a widow to just how complicated and difficult it can be to craft an honest narrative of our own lives. I hope you'll listen to this insightful and often raw conversation with Rebecca. But first, I want to remind you that ratings and reviews are so important for helping podcasts reach more people. If you're listening and loving what you hear, hop over to your podcast app of choice and leave a review. It would really help me out. Okay, on to my conversation with Rebecca Wolf. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Hello, Megan.
It's great to talk to you because it's been, what, like years since people did things?
Totally. And years since we've talked.
Yeah, years since we've talked. But I mean, we at least used to kind of run into each other at conferences and things. And those just have not happened in a while. But your life has been really busy over the last 4 years. And I know we're going to dive into that story. Let's kind of set the stage. So you have 4 kids between the ages of 10 and 16. So you've got 10-year-old twins, a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old. Yep. And you are a relatively recent widow.
Yes, relatively. And Although it does feel like it feels like a lifetime ago. It's like time is so wild.
Well, time is wild. And so not only are you living in this very bizarro world where this major thing has happened to you and completely changed your life, but then, you know, let's layer on a global pandemic. Because why not?
Totally. That's what I mean. Like, I feel like the last 2 years, it was like this. Do you remember that movie Flight of the Something? And that came out in the 80s where like these guys go to space and they
Flight
come
of
back.
Navigator?
Yes, Flight of the Navigator.
Yes.
That's what these last 2 years have felt like. It's like we're going back. It's like we've time traveled somehow.
Like we're Benjamin Buttoning ourselves or something. If we want to like put 2 different movie references in there. Like we're both suspended in animation and yet we've all aged so much. It's just very strange. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was actually just a little bit ago joking with another woman and mom I know who's in her 40s. And I think you're a little younger than me, but not by too much. I'm 44.
Yeah, I'm 40.
Oh, you're 40. Okay.
We're close.
I was saying how like in my 30s, I was kind of obsessed with my age, especially my age relative to other people. But now I just keep forgetting how old I am. Like, I have no idea. I'm 44, but I'm like, am I 45 or maybe I'm 46? I'm like, no, you're only 44. I just feel like my like sense of relating time, like how old I am to, you know, how old I was yesterday or something has completely disappeared. So all of those things are happening together. And then you and I call the, to complicate things further, we sort of know each other from this little bit of a golden bubble of time of like the OG mom blogging time of sort of early aughts, which also feels like 100 years ago, but also yesterday.
Totally. Yes. And it feels like it didn't even happen because the way it worked was it was like this very vibrant community for such a small window of time, relatively speaking, that it's like there was this community and then it sort of disappeared, but we're all still here. And we're waving at each other from distant windows. And there will always be the sort of collective bond with some of, you know, the OG, but we're all fragmented and doing different things now. And it's almost like we went to college, graduated, and are now.
I think that is such a great analogy. And I personally love looking around at that community and saying, wow, like, she's doing this cool thing and she started this company and like, wow, she's like, you know, now working for a major movie network or whatever. And it's just like watching that we were all just kind of hanging out on, I don't know, Typepad.
Totally.
Really WordPress and Blogger. Blogspot. Back in the day, like all had the same humble beginnings and people are doing really cool things. And you are coming out with your second book, but I feel like it's been quite a while, or maybe you've had more books than that, but I'm right. Yeah.
And
it's been a long time.
Yeah. The first book I wrote, I wrote it 15 years ago, 16 years ago. So it almost doesn't even feel it. This sort of feels like a first book experience. Honestly, I was so young when I wrote that. I don't think there's anything wrong with writing a memoir at 24, but I feel a little self-conscious of the fact that I did write a book at that age. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because I had, you know, talked to my agent and various publishers over the years about writing another book. And I really was like, I don't think I'm ready. I think I need to wait until I'm older and have a little more perspective and foresight and hindsight and
I totally know what you mean. And I think it's like they need to come out with another genre that's called like memoir in progress or one day I'll look back at this and think it's so cute. And I think that it makes a lot of sense to want to wait, especially through those messy middle years. Like I also wrote several books in my 20s. And I think the last one I wrote was like I was 31. And since then, I have felt like there's books in me, but none that want to come out and play just yet. Like something has to happen. And I really had to get through my 30s. I had to get through my 30s before I was like in a place to do that. But I totally hear you. And and this book also, you know, I can see how for you, it almost gelled. That like you started writing the book, you know, with your first book. And then there was all this life experience with this huge pivotal moment in your life that could probably give you, I'm not going to use the word closure, but like an ability to sit back and say, wow, this is what this was all leading to. So tell us about the book. Tell us about the story of your book.
Well, for sure. But first, like what you're, I think that this book felt like a necessity. It was like, I have to write this book. I'm going to write this book. And I think for me, what I've realized, I think my first book, I think when, you know, I was blogging every day, we're so used to writing about our lives every day. And I think that book was sort of an extension of blogging. And I was not, there was no urgency in writing anything like long form for me until this happened. And obviously I knew very early on in his diagnosis that I would write a book. And so did he. And that was sort of where it started. So my husband, we were married for 13 years. Just like some backstory for the people in the audience. we had a hard marriage pretty much from the beginning. I feel like I was pretty candid about it. I never tried to sugarcoat our marriage. I wrote a lot about having a difficult marriage while we were married, but because I was married to him and everything that I published online, every single thing that mentioned him, I sent to him first to make sure he was comfortable with that. So I was, you know, I was writing about, you know, sort of vaguely about the dysfunction of my marriage, but nothing specific at all. And, you know, he, days before his 44th birthday, had really intense stomach pains. We were not speaking when he drove himself, or he Ubered to the hospital, because I literally wouldn't even take him. Like, that's where we were at. It was like, I couldn't, I was like, you can take an Uber. Like, I'm not driving you, because, you know, there was always something. He was always dying. Something was always, you know, and I was at the point where I was like, I was so done. We had already talked about divorcing finally after years of back and forth about whether or not we would be able to make this work. And I was done. I was so done. So even the fact that he was in excruciating pain, like, didn't faze me. I was like, you can deal with this on your own. Like, I'm out. So he went to the hospital, was diagnosed in triage with stage 4 pancreatic cancer that had already metastasized to his liver, lymph nodes, all over his body. So he essentially called me and was like, I'm dying. I'm going to die. And it was, you know, all the feelings. I mean, anyone in my situation, anyone who's ever dealt with a terminal diagnosis that was very sudden will know what I'm talking about. But just, you know, you do have this sort of moment where every feeling is colliding. So I went immediately to him. I mean, as soon as my parents could come up to stay with my kids, and I went to the hospital and basically stayed by his bedside for the 4 months, took care of him. Like, you know, I wifed up and, you know, was dealing with his illness and all that came with that, being a caretaker, but also grappling with a lot of complicated feelings, which included relief, because I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be with this person anymore. I'm miserable and he's going to die. And there was guilt because, you know, I think I was able to take care of him as well as I did because I knew there was an end. You know, so it was just very loaded for me. There was a lot of conflicting feelings, obviously grief, sadness, anger, worry for my children, navigating this as their mother. I think for me, I was in survival mode. So I wasn't really thinking a lot about how I was feeling. It was more of making sure that he was, you know, taken care of as he could, and my kids were as taken care of as they could be. So it took, you know, it took me a good several months, years, really, good year after he died, for me to really sort of understand, you know, the multitude of feelings that I was having in my marriage while he was dying, and then afterwards. So this book, which is called All of This, because when he was dying, he said, you know, you have to write about all of this when I die. I mean, he knew, you know, he lived with a writer who wrote about her life. So he knew that was what I was going to do. So I called it All of This. And the first draft was very, very soon after he died. And it was not about all these feelings. It was very much, you know, I was putting together a proposal, and it was very much sort of your typical widow story about, you know, a cancer death and what that looked like and what that felt like. And I was leaving out all of the complicated feelings that I was feeling ashamed to have had, realizing that I couldn't write this book. So I was like, I can't write this book. I can't do it. So I shelved it. And then I took some time, worked on some other things, and then kind of came back to it and was like, you know what? I'm going to write a book about the complicated feelings, because that is the story that that's the story that I need to tell. That's a story that nobody is telling. That's a conversation that I'm having, you know, in the DMs of Instagram with widows who, you know, anytime I hinted at being unhappy or feeling any sort of relief post-death, they were coming to me saying like, dude, me too. Like, this is exactly my experience, but I can't talk about this. You can't talk about this. No one wants to hear about a relieved widow, like sexually exploring, like nobody wants to.
That's not part of the usual.
Right. We're not supposed to talk about narrative. That. We're supposed to be in grief and we're supposed to look a certain way and act a certain way and feel a certain way. And all of the things I was supposed to look and act and feel like were not my experience. And people kept giving me books, you know, books about widowhood and death and losing a spouse or a partner. And zero of them were relatable to me. Like, to the point where I was like, my feelings are so not this that like, there's nowhere for me to go with these feelings. Like there's no community. There's no, there's nothing.
Yeah.
So I think sort of circling back to like the reason I started my blog in 2005 was sort of the same feeling. I was a young mom in LA. I was 23 years old. None of my friends had kids. I was reading books about parenting that weren't relatable to me at all. And I felt like, okay, well, I don't have a community. I'm going to make my own. I'm going to start my own. And this book for me is sort of the same idea, which is I did not have anywhere to go with these feelings. I had no community. I had nobody to relate to, nobody to talk to about these things. So I really wanted to write a book where that people could come to who had the same feelings and, you know, feel heard and seen and accepted for every feeling. Every feeling is valid. And, you know, to hopefully just give people permission to feel the way they do about death, about marriage, about post-marriage. So that was the book that I wanted to write, and a book that I feel like I wrote, and I'm really proud of it. And, you know, obviously petrified because
it's very personal, right? Yeah.
It's very personal. And the reason why people don't share stories like this is because we're not supposed to. So I feel a little bit like, you know, I'm sort of standing on the threshold of, I don't know how people are going to respond to this, how they were going to respond to me, who I'm going to lose, who I've already lost. Like and that is as exciting as it is terrifying, because you know, you've done something right when you're afraid. Right.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's such the truth will set you free is like, it's a truism for a reason. Right. And there is something like terrifying, but so freeing. And that I'm reading the book right now, and I'm not too far in yet, but what I love and can so relate to, not as a widow, but as a divorced woman in particular, but I would have been able to relate to it even when I was still married, is this feeling that you can hold many feelings at once. Like, I think that you say the loving and the loathing, right? Like they're there in equal and like equally important amounts at times. And it's not like you feel one and then you can say, okay, and now I'm done with that feeling. I'm going to set that aside. And now I'm going to feel like I love you. And now I don't love you anymore. And now I loathe you. It's like you do both at the exact same time. And I don't think a lot of people talk about that when it comes to romantic relationships and marriages, especially.
I mean, we're so bad at nuance just across the board, like in every possible situation. There's just, we're so closed-minded and so, like, we really need to pare it down. And I think a lot of it has to do with the stories we've been told and the stories we tell ourselves, right? There's always like a bad guy and a good guy, and this person was in the wrong, and we side with this person. Which side are you on? Which team are you rooting for? And I think, like, you know, relationships, specifically marriages, and then when you have kids on top of that, like, they're all complicated. There's no good marriage, bad marriage. Like, right. they're all messy, every single one. And, you know, I think for me, a lot of what I was doing for years, where I felt like I was writing really honestly about my experience, about my marriage, was this like sort of fake it till you make it mentality, which I think a lot of people do. And a lot of people who spent their entire lives online right? You're used to telling a story. You want that story to look a certain way. You want to steer your narrative in a certain direction. And it's interesting because going back to like all the OG bloggers, I think every single one of us is either divorced, like, or separate. Like,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of any of like the those core, you know, we're all.
There aren't many. There's a small number, but not many of us who are still with that original spouse.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, I mean, a lot of people are obviously divorced. It's not just like that. But there's a pressure when you're writing about your life. There's an added layer of pressure, which is like, I want this story. And why is it this story? This is right. The story that I'm telling. Why is this happening? This is not the story I'm telling.
Right.
You're not the husband that I'm want right. you to be. You're not the father I want you to be. I'm framing you. I'm giving you all this, you know, I'm framing you
here. Look
at me,
I'm being so generous.
Totally.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I'm writing about only the good things and I'm showing only the good moments and, yeah. and look at how amazing you could be if you were just more, you know what I mean? So I think there's like this added pressure to, you know, when you're specifically, if you're writing about your life daily, and I, you know, I know that there's a whole other now new generation of influencers, and I don't really know that much about them or their stories. Like, I don't really follow many, you know, influencers in the mom space, like the, you know, like the fresh, the
right.
fresh
the
batch,
younger mom.
but I do yep. feel a little bit like a grandma in the space. And I like, there's a part of me that just wants to say like, it's okay. If,
yeah.
Like, that's not your, like, it's okay that shit's fucking messy. And like, I see you, but like, there's this whole other part of you. And like, don't, you know, like telling yourself the story is really exhausting.
Yeah.
Telling that story is really exhausting. And I think at some point you get to a place where you're like, this is not real or right.
Right.
This feels terrible. This is killing me.
You know, I think it's so complicated because you not only are you trying to protect the other person, you're trying to protect the spouse to some degree. You don't want to be like throwing them under the bus all the time. And I think we can be very generous to people who don't always deserve it. I'll just leave it at that. I don't need to say more.
100%. And especially yeah. women to men. Like yeah. this feels specifically like there is a part of womanhood, of wifehood, where you're there to protect,
yep.
right? You're there to keep a safe home, like protect your spouse. Like you're there basically, you're ride or die. Like you're
yep.
there to agree. All these things. That's like what that's the wife's duty is to like protect, you know,
yep.
patriarchy, really.
Yeah. Well, protect the person,
it.
But also protect the narrative. And I think when you add kids in, you're the mom, you're not just doing it to protect your spouse or
right.
to, you know, get more hits on your blog or whatever back in the day, but also because you want to believe it. Like you want to believe it so much that you're willing to write it to make it true.
That's exactly right.
And you think if you just keep writing it that way, it will
yeah.
become true. And I know for myself, I basically, like I was a very prolific writer. And at some point I just kind of fell out of love with the life I was writing about. And that's when I realized it was fake. Like that when I realized I finally was like, oh, I don't want to write anymore about my marriage and my family because something is seriously broken, even though I couldn't like identify what it was or define it. I knew that it was. And it was like all of my will to write in that way just escaped me. And I didn't write much at all for like 4 or 5 years. And I'm really just starting to get back in, except for like client stuff, you know, but like
right,
my
right.
ability to be a personal writer was eaten by the untruths I was telling. And I couldn't
totally.
See that happening. But what you're describing is so.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I actually, in that first book I wrote, the ending to that book was about, you know, was this very optimistic ending that I tacked on there as sort of like a prayer, like, okay,
I remember
this
that.
Is going to work out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was, and when I was writing that book, we were in a terrible place, the first book. And I was like, okay, if I write this, and I actually got the words tattooed to my arm after publishing that book that said, tell the story until it comes true. And it's huge across my forearm. And when I turned in my draft, my like final draft of this manuscript, I went to the tattoo shop and I had someone do a red strike through that tattoo. I'm not covering it up. It's there. But I literally edited it with red strike through needle. So now it says, tell the truth.
Oh.
And that was sort of, that was like my, you know, the difference between that first book and this book, or it's 15 years. And basically that was what I, you know, I was trying, I thought if I told the story, if you manifest all these words that were, you know, if you manifest this or you like, I was doing all the work to make this work. And really what I was doing was I was lying to myself. So that was sort of like a poignant moment for me to be like, you know what, this, I was wrong. I was wrong. And I don't need to erase who I was. There's no regrets, you know, no regrets, that tattoo. but I want to acknowledge that, you know, we edit, you know, as people, we change our philosophies and change our belief systems and recognize that, you know, our original manifestos maybe aren't so healthy and rewrite them, reclaim them. And that's okay. Like, it's okay to change your story. And I think a lot of people get so stuck in the story they're telling and so afraid to change it, you know, and divorce, like, you know, a lot of what I write about in my book too, like there's a part of me that grieves the fact that like, I never, my out, my marriage was passive. Like I didn't leave. And so when people, you know, after he died, I was all getting all the sympathy that I didn't feel like I deserved because I wasn't grieving in that way. I related to my divorced friends. I related to divorced women because I was on the other side of a marriage I wanted out of. Yeah. So when you're getting constant, like, you know, sympathy, empathy as a widow, it's very different from a divorce where people are like questioning you. And I felt like I needed to be questioned that like I
taken to task.
I was having the feelings that I was having were far closer, like more aligned with being on the other side of a divorce. And so I felt like I needed to articulate that publicly and sort of have kind of come out and say, I'm also experiencing the sort of euphoria of being free and on my own and raising my kids on my own, which I'm really happy to do. I don't want a partner to do this. I don't need a partner to do this. I feel extremely empowered and liberated by my experience as a single parent doing this on my own, and not, I don't feel sorry for myself, and you shouldn't either. You know what I mean? Like there was like I feel super capable and like this feels right to me. And so it was this very sort of strange, like navigating that was so bizarre and so many of the feelings that I was feeling, I didn't feel like I was able to articulate and, you know, still trying to figure out how to articulate them, honestly. And, but it's, you know, I was stuck in a story. I was really hard for me to get out of it. Like I wanted out of my marriage for 6 years before he got sick. Like, you know, and I did all of the things. I, you know, had affairs and, you know, I escaped in different ways.
Right. Except the way that actually was escaped.
Yes. And so there's guilt in that too. Although I'm glad that I was there when he died, and I'm glad that, you know, I was able to be, you know, the wife that I was able to be while he was dying. And it would have been a very different experience if we had split up. But
well, and it's all part of the story, right? So like you first, you know, you had back in the day when you were telling a story that you wished was true. But like that is, it's true in that was you. Like it's not true, but it's still true in a weird way because it was literally, that was who you were at the time. Trying so hard, like if you could pull back the curtain so people could see who the Rebecca was typing away on her computer, desperately wishing her story was actually 100% true instead of maybe just like 60% true, they would see that as truth too, if that makes any sense. I know that was very
totally roundabout. And there are posts like in the archives, like I wrote an entire post in like the metaphor of a tree uprooting when, you know, he found out about he found out about an affair and I literally wrote about all of it without writing about all of it. So I wrote about it, just wasn't explicit in what had actually happened, but alluded to a very, you know, a disturbance in the force.
Yeah.
And I honestly think like my growth as a writer came from writing around the truth in a way that was truthful, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's some understandability too, when you have little kids and you're like, I also am trying to protect them from the story.
Right. And the
whole truth of it. And I think
it's interesting because I think you're right about that. And I think when they're younger, it's very different from when they're older, because my feelings now is that I'm not trying to keep the truth from them at all. Like they know all of it. There's nothing in this book they don't know. I'm definitely like, I've gone completely in the other direction where I have nothing to hide. I'm going to, you know, it's all out there now.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think it is an age thing. I think, you know, when you have small children, it's very different. When you have teenagers, they're a little more, you know, you can have conversations with older kids about the complexities of relationships and life and death and all these things. And
it's like what it means to nurture and mother and even protect them just changes with how they're interacting with the world and what they're capable of. I love thinking about this almost like a spectrum. Like, so you're a young mom in your 20s and you're telling the story that you think is palatable or safe or that people want to hear or whatever, you know, whatever the story is, it's not quite true. And then you're starting to see the truth come, like you're starting to see that things aren't right. And you're trying to figure out how to like work with that. Then your husband dies and now everyone's trying to write the story for you. They're like, you're this grieving widow now. And you're like, no. So it went from you like willingly, you know, participating in half truth to like other people kind of slapping it on you with this label of what a widow is and what that even looks like. And now with this book, you're like, no, actually, this is how it is. And this is how it was. And I love you taking that story back.
You're right. It was like the attention and the what came from his death felt so disingenuous to my experience that I literally got to a point where I was like, I feel like I'm crawling out of my skin. Like there's so much that I'm not talking about and so much that people don't understand and so much that people are assuming they understand that it was like, like the scream, and you can see the scream like from the, you know, space. Like it felt like that. Like, no, actually.
Yeah.
And also not only that, but not only have you gotten my experience wrong, but there are so many women that you're assuming are feeling this way that aren't. And they feel the same way I feel, but their stories aren't out there. And we haven't normalized this narrative in any way.
Yeah.
So, I guess since I can't find anyone to relate to, I'm going to go out and I'm going to be that person for myself and for anyone else who, you know, who needs that. And I think it's also, you know, I think what I write about in this book and the feelings that I've had post-death is not necessarily the experience of the widow who is grieving the man she wanted to leave. I think this is a very universal feeling for people who are in any sort of complicated, toxic relationship, whether it's with a family member, a parent. You know, I have friends who've lost parents that they had extremely toxic relationships with that felt relieved when they weren't here anymore.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they didn't love them. It doesn't mean that there's not, you know, that they're not grieving them, but there's also this other side of it, this relief that they don't have to deal with, you know, this person's abuse anymore.
Yeah.
And that is this is not specific to a partnership. It's parenting, friends, like any, you know, we have complicated relationships with all the people we love.
Yeah.
So death doesn't just look like one thing. And there's a lot of people who are able to breathe, feel free, come out the other side of a death and are better off. And it's okay to say that out loud. It's okay. Like, you know, death doesn't absolve, you know,
it doesn't wipe the whole slate clean.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, no one's going to come up to you at a funeral, you know, the grieving spouse or daughter or whatever, and nudge them and go, You bet you're pretty glad they're dead, huh?
Right, like high five. Yeah.
That's probably not going to happen for many good reasons, but it's at least it's great that if you read something like this and realize there might be that perspective, you might ask questions of a friend a little bit differently, or you might be prepared for them to say different things than what you think, you know, the narrative should allow.
Right. And, yeah. And just to be open to all different kinds of feelings and it's okay for them to change. Like people can be immediately, you know, feel one way and then feel this way. Like there's, you know, there's this spectrum is vast.
Yeah.
But I think this sort of knee jerk, oh my gosh, this person's falling apart. Their life's falling apart. You know, I was getting the love of your life is dead. And like, you're the love, you know, people were assuming all, and it was like, that shit fucked me up. I was like, ah,
like, I'm not ready for Golden Girls just yet.
Because
okay.
What do you say? Like right. When it's over and over and over and over and like everyone means well, and they're coming from a place of love. And that's the thing too, is everyone's trying to take care of you. Everyone's trying to love you. Everyone's trying, like it was the most beautiful outpouring of love and support for my community online and in real life. Like it was unbelievable. And you also feel like it's like a slap in the face to the people who are loving on you to say like, I'm okay, guys. Like right. I'm okay.
Right.
Like you're getting all this, everyone's being so amazing. You don't want to break their hearts and tell them that like, you're actually okay.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? There's that part of it too, where it's like, oh my God. Like
again, trying to protect other people and like,
totally,
you know,
and then take care of them. You find yourself performing for them because they want you to be sad and they want you to have these feelings and they want your experience to look this way and they want it to be this tragic love story. And when it isn't, they don't know what to do with that. So it's like this, and I've seen this happen too with people that I know who are widows who become defined by being widows because when something terrible happens to you, people fucking love you. You will never be more loved by when tragedy strikes you. And of course, it totally makes sense. It's when you need love, right? It's like people rally around you when something terrible happens to you. But there's like this other side of that where, you know, it becomes this thing where you're like, oh, well, I get attention if I do this. Like I know exactly what to write about for people to say this, or, you know, like you start to, and it like, there were times where I was like, is this genuine? Is this genuinely how I feel? Is this genuinely what I'm thinking, feeling? Am I I'm saying these things, I hear myself saying them, but is this true? Mm-hmm. And I think like, you know, when you are sort of in this sort of passive place, when tragedy happens to you, you know, you don't, it's like, you don't really know how you feel. You're sort of looking you're surrounded by mirrors, everyone else is perception of you. And you're like, is that who I am? Is right. this how I feel? Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's hard for you to even, so it wasn't until that died down that I was even really able to sit with myself and say like, how are you feeling? Like, what is your response? Because I was responding to everyone else's response. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally understand that feeling. And I do think that it's easy to absorb other people's feelings and expectations. And then they start to feel like they might be yours, kind of, ? But not exactly.
Yeah, totally.
Well, let's take a quick break. And when we get back, I definitely want to talk about more about all of this, literally the book and also all of the things we're talking about and kind of what's happened since and what's next for you. So we will be right back.
Friends, I'm taking a moment to talk about our sponsor, Vionic, the ridiculously comfortable footwear brand that I've been raving about for years now. Vionic makes trend-forward shoes in pretty much every style, from casual sneakers to flip-flops to wedges and heels, and all of Vionic's shoes feature VioMotion technology, Vionic's patented podiatrist-developed footbed that's built into every style they make. It delivers three-zone comfort with a deep heel cup for stability, ball of foot cushioning, and ultimate arch support for uplifting overall foot contact. The Malibu slip-on is a breezy summer style that you can easily slip on and off at the door, and it's perfect for summer. It comes in a great array of bright, summery colors and patterns. I know new shoes are an investment, and it can be intimidating to order online, but with Vionic's 30-day wear test, there's no reason not to try them out. You can return your Vionics for a full refund within 30 days if you're not satisfied for any reason, even if you've worn them outside. So there's no risk. I'm going to get you free shipping to try Vionics for yourself. Go to VionicsShoes.com and use promo code MORE. That's M-O-R. Again, go to VionicsShoes.com and use the code MORE, M-O-R, for free shipping. Okay, back to the show.
Okay, Rebecca. So we were just talking about sort of those feelings that people maybe expected you to have, and you didn't necessarily have all of those feelings that people, you know, the super grieving widow, or maybe there, you know, there obviously was grief there, but it was mixed up with relief as well, and how hard that was to sort that out. And in a much, much smaller way, I can identify with that as a divorced person, that feeling of relief, but then kind of like a delayed reaction. And you and I actually chatted a little bit about this on Instagram, I think, or maybe on an email about, for me, it was like a breakup a couple of years later that with someone I wasn't even dating that long. And really, now looking back, I'm like, wow, there really was no long-term anything in that. But my reaction to it was very extreme. And I think for me, and I'm not putting this on you, it was almost like all the grief I couldn't quite deal with in the moment of the divorce because of the relief was stronger than the grief got dealt with down the road in this other relationship. So I'm wondering if you've had experiences like that where once everyone stopped talking in your ear and bringing you the casseroles or whatever they were doing in the early, you know, days where everyone's wonderful and supportive, now that dies down a little bit. And what is sitting with your feelings as a newer widow with a complicated relationship look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is like still an ongoing, this is still ongoing for me, and it probably will be forever. Like, I think that, you know, sometimes I'm like, do I have PTSD from my marriage? Do I have PTSD from the death? Probably both. Mm. I've definitely, you know, in the relationships that I've had since Hal died, like it's pretty obvious, like where like I've sort of like buried the trauma and where it's come out in different, you know, places, like, oh, this is from this.
Right.
Oh, got it. Yes. This is from this. Oh, my want to like be completely open, non-monogamous, like not attached, short relationships. That comes from,
yeah,
like that comes from, like, there's a lot, not to say that if I didn't go through what I went through, I wouldn't still feel those things. But, you know, a lot of, you know, what my experiences have been since my marriage are of course related to how that marriage ended and what that marriage looked like when it was happening. So, you know, I think we, you know, it's that's the thing about grief and relief and trauma and all these different things. It's they don't, it takes a while for you to really sort of understand why you do the things you do, why you react the way you do after coming out of, you know, a marriage or a death. Or so I'm still, I would go so far as to say that I am far more in that now, almost 4 years later, like really sort of having having moments where I'm like, aha, like I'm understanding myself, my trauma response now in ways that I didn't in the beginning. In the beginning, I felt very much like I felt really sort of empowered by everything, by being alive, by having a body, by sexually exploring. Everything felt, it was like someone turned the lights on for me. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with the fact the way he died. He was a very healthy seeming 44-year-old man who you would never know was sick, and then days after his diagnosis couldn't walk. So I watched how fast a healthy body became sick and thought, oh shit, like I could wake up tomorrow or not wake up tomorrow. What am I doing with my life? What am I doing with my body? Like, I want to feel as alive as I possibly can. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that I was sitting with death and watched what happened to a body very quickly, a healthy seeming body, and feeling like, okay, this is possible. This can happen to me too. So what am I doing about it now while I can? So, you know, like I think now I'm sort of slowing down and giving myself permission to like change my mind about things, to to not be so reactive. Or if I am reactive, why am I being so, why, where is this reaction coming from? And sort of psychoanalyzing my defense mechanisms and the things that I respond to and where they come from in a way that I wasn't in those first few months in that first year, even in the first 2 years.
Yeah. And giving yourself that compassion, because again, just like you look back at Rockabye and you think, oh, like, you know, oof, 24-year-old me.
Yeah.
If only you knew, isn't this cute? And, you know, maybe in 10 years, you'll look at 40-year-old you and think, or, you know, you at 40 writing about 36 or whatever, however that looks.
Yeah, yeah.
And think, oh boy, there were some things that I really didn't know, did I? Or I really thought was true about myself, but it turns out I still had a lot to learn. And I feel like we're all doing that. My hope is that by the time we get into our 40s, we're just a little gentler with ourselves because we know it's coming.
Yeah, I think I feel so much compassion for my 24-year-old self. And I feel so much compassion for my 37-year-old self. And I think like in this book, and I just recently reread it, which I never did with Rockabye. Like I wrote that book and then never reread it ever again. Like I couldn't do it. And this I've reread several times since I wrote it. And I everything that I wrote in that book, I stand by and still feel. I definitely think that yes, 20 years from now, I'll go look back on it and I'll be a different person. Yeah. But I do feel like it's the first truly honest piece of writing where like I go back and I read it even, you know, I think I finished that first draft almost a year and a half ago. And I feel like I'm in a very different place than I was when I was writing it, but still everything in there, I really still stand by and feel really proud of and wouldn't change. And you're right. Like 20 years from now, I'm sure like, you know, there'll be things in there where I'll be, like anything. I mean, there's things that I wrote about last week that I'm right. Like, really? Like,
well, you're a different version of you, but if it still feels like Rebecca reading Rebecca, then that's what.
Yeah. But I matters, feel like yeah. I think like for the first time, I've really gotten to a point where I feel really confident in my voice and just sort of fearless in a way that I wasn't before. And like proud of that. Like, I'm really proud of that.
I was just thinking of a book that came out when I was a younger mom. And I want to say maybe like I was in my early 30s. And I can't remember the name of the book, but I remember the author's name is Elisa Bowman. So I'll look it up. And it was, I think, like a marriage memoir. But in the end, she stayed married and it was sort of like a self-help/marriage memoir. But the story that I remember her telling was wishing her husband would die. And like how that's how she knew something was up in her relationship is because she was wishing her spouse would die.
Yeah.
And when I read that in my early 30s, I remember identifying with that and thinking, yeah, I can totally see why there's no out unless your spouse like dies. Right. And then later in my late 30s, when I was actually going through my divorce, thinking, oh, I was never that trapped. Like I thought I was so trapped that the only way out was death. And actually, I was free the whole time. I just didn't know it. And I'm just saying that now because you're the person with the other experience where the death actually, like you're like the middle story where like the death actually happened before you got to the divorce.
Yeah.
And like, you know, most people would be the one who either never gets divorced and is miserable or skips over the death and goes to the divorce. And it's just such an interesting, it's not even a question. It's just like, it's just interesting to look back and realize when I think back to that person I was, that I was always free and I didn't know it.
That's exactly right. And like, I love that you said that. And I've been writing about this a little bit, or I was a while back, cause I started this how I left thing on Instagram stories where people were sending their stories of their, of how they got out of bad marriages, of you know, advice for people who want to get out of their marriages but feel trapped. Because that was for me, that was my experience. My feeling was I'm stuck. I'm gonna be stuck. When my kids grow up, I guess we can divorce then. It was so overwhelming for me to imagine a divorce. And a lot of that has to do with the fact there are no divorces in my family. All of my closest friends at the time were all married. I had no one in my life who was like either going through a divorce, had gone through a divorce. When I talked to people about my marriage, it was like everyone else was, it felt very much like divorce was still something that was impossible. You know, in my head, I was like doing, like I was being the martyr for my family and my children because he did not want to get a divorce. So whenever the conversation came up, it was like, it was very much like, and I think a lot of, I think when the affairs kind of came out, I was assuming that he would leave and didn't. And so it was like, okay.
Oh, he's like, I went through all this and I didn't even
but like, I was ready. I was like, yeah. Okay, like I, please leave. Like, so I felt, I think even more trapped after that because it felt like there's nothing I can do to get out. Like I'm gonna, I really have to leave. Like I have to leave. So, but yeah. And that was all of what you're saying, I recognize too. And like, you were free all along. And I was too, I was free all along. I just couldn't do it. I was so afraid of it. And so afraid for my children who I'm now realizing would have been fine. Yeah. Who, you know, these are conversations we've had to have over and over since he died because they saw everything that went down and are like, why didn't you leave? Like, why didn't you leave? Like, so I've had to like answer for my own fear, you know, with them as well, because they're right. Like I should have, and I couldn't, or as soon as I was finally ready, he died. And you know, when I first got that call, I thought that I did that because like you said, you know, there were a million times where I wish that he would die. Are you kidding? Like I think, you know, the fact that you're related to that, and these are conversations I've had with people ad nauseum as well, is that most of us, when we're in a marriage that's terrible, we have those thoughts and that's completely normal. Completely normal is so valid. So valid. I'm sure he had the same thoughts about me
at times. Right, exactly.
Like I don't, and I don't expect anyone not to. Like, so that it's normalizing those feelings is so important because that stuff festers and then you have all this guilt, which is what happened to me. Like he got sick and I was like, I did this. I was I'm the reason he's sick. I'm the reason he's dying. I'm some powerful witch. And, you know, was crying in the car the other day, saying if only he could just die already or whatever I had in the moment where I was having my breakdown and look what happened. I killed him. So I think that is so valid. So many women who are in bad marriages, men too, I'm sure, have those thoughts. They're completely normal and natural. And like for us to not talk about that or to pretend like we're, you know, not human is, you know, makes it hard for everybody.
Well, and it's not any good for marriage either. Like, because I would, you know, going back to my earlier life, if there was a way I could have stayed married, that would have been wonderful. I don't think the dancing around, lying to yourself and everybody else actually even achieves that end. Like, even if that, like probably the radical honesty was what would get you there. And you can't do that when you're not truthful, obviously. Right. And I, when you said the thing about being a magical witch, I mean, I'm laughing right now because the thing I was thinking before you said that was how, you know, moms, we get told that we're super like, and I know a lot of this is just lip service and meaningless and doesn't help us at all, but like we're superheroes. We can do everything like blah, blah, blah. But we really can't single-handedly save a marriage. And we somehow think that we can do that too. Like, you know, or that we could accidentally kill our spouses by wishing they were gone. I mean, like the amount of responsibility we put on ourselves.
Totally. That's so true. Of course. Like anytime anything happens, it's our fault. Right. Like that sort of mentality was something that I really was like, oh, why do I like, again, like untangling all of these things, like, anytime something happens to someone, it's my fault. This is happening. It's my fault. I must have said something wrong or done something wrong, or I caused this, or, you know, we give ourselves way too much credit for of it, even for our kids. Like we can't take responsibility for our kids. Like now having four and now that they're all older and like they're so different. And yes, of course I've contributed to stuff, but also like I can't take credit for this, 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 and this. Like this is just who they are.
Yeah.
And to this part of us where we like feel terrible if something is, you know, it's like we carry so much, so much. Yeah. And even now it's like, and when you, and going through a death and like carrying all of that and carrying all of everyone else's feelings and taking years before I'm really able to sit down and like untangle my own, because I've put myself last for so many years that I don't even like, I got to a point where I was like, I don't even know how I feel anymore. I don't even know how to take care of myself. Like, I really don't. Like, I got to a point where I was like, I guess I should, you know, it's like the other night I like make the dinner for my kids and I never make myself dinner. I just eat whatever is left over. Right. Like, yeah. And my friend was living with me for a month. She was in between houses and she's like, what are you doing? Like, you're literally not even making yourself dinner. Like, are you like, so she started cooking and she would give me like the biggest, most beautiful plate. And I was like, I can't, like, what? She's like, yes, you can take the plate, right? The food like this. Yes. You deserve to have your own fucking plate. Like, I still, you know, it's like that. I don't even realize I'm doing it. I don't even realize that I'm not making myself a plate of food. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, well, that's like a cliche. That's true. It's like I said, truisms are truisms because there's something really, really true about them. And the idea of a mom standing there eating leftover chicken nuggets off of their kid's plate is there for a reason. Like, that stereotype totally. Is there for a reason.
But yeah. Like, my kids are old now.
I know.
Like, you get still locked doing
in.
It.
Yeah, but that habit gets locked in. Yeah.
Totally.
Well, Rebecca, your book comes out in August, but it is available for pre-order now. So I will link that in the show notes. Before we wrap up, this has been such a great conversation. I wish we could talk all day. I just want to hear a little bit, like a little snippet about how your dating life has been going. I know you get into that in the book and I haven't read it yet. So like, don't spoil it too much. Specifically, I guess I'm curious if being a widow has made dating more challenging, because I'm wondering if the people who are like attracted to that are maybe expecting something different than what they're getting. So without giving too much away, just give us a little glimpse of what that looks like.
I mean, a lot of my like initial dating was, I was pretty tight-lipped about my experience.
So you were just, it was casual. So you weren't really sharing a whole lot. Yeah.
It was pretty perfunctory. Like, I wasn't, you know, connecting with people that deeply. I mean, we were having conversations, but it was very much, it was casual. Okay. Everything was casual. So it wasn't, you know, we weren't having these long conversations. We weren't having like, you know, we were having dates, but they would turn into like a one night stand and never see each other again type of thing. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I wasn't pursuing relationships. I was pursuing casual encounters and then, you know, but you know, relationships did happen because, you know, I am a person, a human feeling person, and like, you know, fell in love and then I fell in love again. And like, there's, you know, there are relationships and I talk about those in the book, but I think, you know, one of the most challenging things for me in dating and still is that I'm the only parent. So it's been really important for me. I had one relationship where my boyfriend had met my kids early on. And then I realized that I didn't wanted that to happen again. So, I keep it all separate. So people that I date, I was in a like over a year long relationship during COVID, with someone that I'm still super, super close with. He never met my kids. I mean, we were together for 14, 15 months and I saw him 2 to 3 times a week. He never came here. He never met my kids. And that felt good to me. Like, that felt, keeping it separate felt good. A lot of people don't know what to do with that. So it's definitely, you know, you're either in or you're out,
yeah.
But I'm super transparent about what I'm looking for and super transparent about my situation now. And, you know, the widow part, I think, is the least complicated part. I think being a person who writes about her personal life is way crazier.
You're like, I'm a widow. And by the way, look, my last serious relationship ended like this.
Yeah. That's the apart. I mean, I literally just had like a debilitating heartbreak because of my book.
Wow. Okay.
Because he read it and was like, yeah. Freaked out. So, yeah. Like there's the part about having kids and being a widow, like that hasn't really been an issue. The issue is the fact that I write about my personal life. Yeah. And, if you're going to date me, you'll probably like, end up somewhere in there.
Yes.
And even just like in essays and things that have, you know, and I'm super transparent about that too. Yeah. Actually I went on a date last night with somebody, and before we went out, I was like, just so you know, this is what I do. This is what, you know, if you're uncomfortable with the fact that you could end up somewhere we shouldn't meet. And that's the conversation that I have with people now. Like I'm not going to try to, you know, I'm radical honesty.
Yeah. Well, and you're not going to try to diminish yourself to make them comfortable, because in the end that doesn't work anyway. Like eventually who you are is who you are, and it's going to be part of that relationship, whether you're upfront about it up front or not.
Totally. And even still, when you are upfront about it, you know, someone can think that they're okay with it until they realize that they're not. And then they blow the whole thing up and it's, you know,
you're like, oh, I thought you wrote funny limericks. This is very different. Imagine if we got into like a funny limerick writing about, you know, our love lives. That would be an interesting exercise. Well, Rebecca, this has been such a great conversation. I, for one, cannot wait to finish the book. I would encourage everybody to go out there and order and pre-order a copy, and get it as soon as they can, because I'm loving it so far. And you're still writing. I know you're still on Instagram and things like that. Maybe not as active as you once were, but where's the other best place someone could find you if they're looking to connect with you now?
You can, my website, RebeccaWolf.com, has links to sort of everything. And then on Instagram, I'm Rebecca Wolf with 3 O's.
Oh, that's right.
I still write there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did the Rebecca Wolf with 2 O's get there first?
Yeah, there was another Rebecca, because my tag was Girls Gone Child for years and years.
Yeah.
So when I changed it to my name, I was like, drats, somebody got to it first. Yep. So I just added an O, because people always, you know, screw with my whole O situation. Yep. They always either do one O or an E, like Wolf. Yep. There's so many different ways to spell Wolf. So
I love that.
So now it's Wolf.
All right. Well, I'll link that up as well, so people can easily find you without having to spell. I love it so much. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Megan, so much. It's so lovely.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Mother of Reinvention show. Just a reminder that while Rebecca's book comes out in August, it is available for pre-order now, and pre-orders are really important to an author. This book is definitely worth the wait, so go ahead and order it. Your later self will thank you. You'll find a link to it at the show notes at motherofreinventionshow.com, and don't forget to follow me at Megan Francis, that's M-E-A-G-A-N Francis, on Instagram. Okay, I'll be back next Thursday with another new episode. Talk to you then.